From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America, our topic on this edition of the program, an update on Afghanistan under the Taliban. Our guests, four distinguished analysts at the newly created Washington-based think tank, New Lines Institute. Caroline Rose is a senior analyst and head of the Power Vacuums program in the Human Security Unit with expertise in the geopolitical impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Rasha Al-Kidi is the senior analyst and head of the Non-State Actors Program in the Human Security Unit. Nicholas Heras is senior analyst and program head for State Resilience and Fragility in the Human Security Unit. Prior to joining New Lines Institute, he was the director of government relations and the Middle East Security Program Manager at the Institute for the Study of War, and Kamran Bokhari. He is a globally recognized expert on Afghanistan and the Director of Analytical Development at New Lines Institute. He is also a National Security and Foreign Policy Specialist at the University of Ottawa. The above-mentioned analysts are authors of an insightful report entitled The Challenges of a Talibanized Afghanistan. In it, they discuss the likely fate of women and girls, geopolitical challenges for neighboring South and Central Asian nations, and the possibility that the Taliban might allow other transnational jihadist groups to operate within Afghanistan. In the meantime, according to the United Nations, humanitarian needs in Afghanistan have grown to unprecedented levels, and more than half of the country's population will face acute food insecurity in November. VOA's Islamabad correspondent Ayaz Ghul reports that despite its promise to restore stability, the Taliban's return to power has triggered financial sanctions on Kabul by the United States and other Western nations, blocking the hardline movement's access to around $10 billion in Afghan assets, which sit largely with the U.S. Federal Reserve. We will review the state of play in Afghanistan with our distinguished panelists as we approach the two-month mark of the Taliban takeover of the country. And our New Lines Institute analysts join us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program. Let me begin with Kamran Bokhari. Kamran, because you've been at the Institute, I think, longer than most of your colleagues, I'd like you to talk about why New Lines Institute was created to begin with. There are so many think tanks in Washington dealing with Afghanistan and other troubled countries. You all come from distinguished backgrounds. Some of you worked at these other think tanks. What distinguishes New Lines from other think tanks in Washington, from its financing to its objectives?
Thank you, Carol, for that question. So New Lines Institute was created in response to what we all collectively saw as a significant gap in the conversation on foreign policy in the Beltway and other capitals around the world. But for us, you know, Washington, where U.S. foreign policy is made, debated, and discussed, we thought that the conversation had become mediocre, stale, and there were several factors for this. Number one is that the think tank space is mostly dominated by entities that are somewhere on the ideological spectrum from right to left. And then, of course, most think tank entities are advocacy groups or activist oriented. In other words, they have a preferred subjective preference for a particular policy towards X country. And then they try to steer the United States government into that direction. We thought that the piece that was missing is that research and analysis should drive policy recommendations, not subjective preferences, and not be clouded by ideology. And therefore, we created an institutional approach to analysis, and we refer to it internally as our methodology for strategic analysis. It's based on the best practices from all across the epistemic community, whether it's academia, journalism, the world of practitioners, policy analysts. We incorporate geopolitics, intelligence analysis, the best practices, tradecrafts of journalism, and even academic research. And so, in other words, we wanted to bring, you know, the social science back into the foreign policy making process, or the conversation at least.
Now let me ask you about Afghanistan. I'll stay with you on this question, Kamran. As I said, we're looking at the Talibanization, as you call it, of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute hunger as the harsh winter looms. What do you see as the major challenges facing the Taliban government as it tries to reconcile its ideology, hardline ideology, with the need to govern and prevent an economic meltdown and humanitarian crisis?
I think that there are several challenges, but one of them that is at the heart driving everything else is the fact that the Taliban aren't a political actor in the sense of a political party that has experience in governance. By definition, the Taliban are an insurgent force, and they don't have what could be called their equivalent of the Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army. There is no Taliban Sinn Féin. There is no political wing that is filled with people who have experience and the technical know-how in terms of how to govern. It's a very deeply ideological movement that has one expertise, which is waging an insurgency. And I think that catastrophic success has struck them in that they probably did not think that they would overwhelm their opponents so quickly, just like the rest of the world. And now there is no planning for the day after. And now they're dealing with that. And that's where, how do you deal with a population that does not remember Taliban rule, that is ideologically far, far removed from what the Taliban believe in or they envision as what their emirate should be? And so there's that. Then how do you deal with young people who have aspirations and who are part of the post-social media age? How do you deal with women, which is a particularly thorny issue for the Taliban? Back in the day, under Emirate 1.0 during the 90s, they just simply did not allow women to go to school. The past 20 years has seen the growth of civil society, particularly women, entering the workforce, entering social space, taking up positions both in state and society. How do they deal with that? They don't have the capability to deal with that. There are very few people who are at the leadership level who can be pragmatic, but most of them are very ideological. And the lower in the ranks that you go in the movement, the more ideological they become. So in other words, a Taliban fighter that fought the United States and the Afghan state for many, many years does not all of a sudden become a security guard trying to deal with security in the country as part of a state. Then there's a lack of resources, and the international community has been really, really reluctant to recognize the Taliban, although there are lots of signs that they're willing to bypass that stage to at least do some form of engagement with the Taliban so as to not let this place completely spiral out of control. So I think at a broad level, that's what we're dealing with. A new situation, the Taliban don't know how to deal with it. They have very few resources. And they don't have the ability to, if you will, deliver on all the demands made by the various international actors that they are in conversation with.
Well, thank you for that. I'd like now to turn to Rasha Al-Kidi. Rasha, along the same lines, the Taliban are an insurgent group. They're now in charge of the country. The United States, many countries in the West, do not want to deal with them. They want to maintain sanctions. At the same time, there's a humanitarian crisis and an economic meltdown. Women, girls, children are at risk. What should be the posture of the United States and Western nations in face of this conundrum? Can they maintain sanctions and pressure while at the same time coming to the rescue of millions of civilians?
First, I think that there are intermediates that the United States can go through when they want to reach out to the Taliban. They will not negotiate with them directly, whether the United Nations and other organizations. So any kind of contact for humanitarian reasons will probably be done via these actors. It won't be done directly. The Taliban themselves, when they think of international recognition, they don't necessarily think of the United States. They have other countries that probably have more of the will to acknowledge them and work with them directly. And this is something sort of America's doing, where it kind of cornered itself into this position. For example, Russia might acknowledge the Taliban, so will China. We already have Qatar in that role to some extent. So communication will be done through other states, not directly. As for the humanitarian aid, that's why there are organizations. The United States' main concern, I believe, at this point, possibly even more than the humanitarian concerns, is the security concerns of what a Taliban rule might look for America's security on the long run, regarding whether it's Al-Qaeda, other organizations, or the Islamic State in Khorasan. This is where the U.S. concerns, as we see it today, more important or more urgent than the humanitarian concerns.
We'll have more in just a moment, and I will follow up on that point. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program are analysts from the Washington-based New Lines Institute, Caroline Rose, Rasha Al-Kidi, from whom you just heard, Nicholas Haras, and Cameron Bukhari. We are talking about the direction of Afghanistan under the Taliban. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Abdul Rafi Mielma from Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our discussion, and to follow up on the security concerns of the United States in particular, the Taliban has recently praised suicide bombers who died during the war against the former government, the Ghani government and its Western allies, offering their families sums of cash, promises of land. And the Taliban regime includes several members of the hardline Haqqani network in senior positions, such as Sirajuddin Haqqani. He's the acting interior minister, who has a $10 million U.S. bounty on his head because he's a specially designated global terrorist. So the question is, it seems to me, but you can certainly refute this, that there's still a strong relationship between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But characterize that relationship, and what is the likelihood that the al-Qaeda network and other jihadist groups will in fact reconstitute in Afghanistan? Kamran Bukhari.
The Taliban conundrum of being caught between the need for being pragmatic so as to be able to govern the country, while at the same time maintaining ideological commitment, is something that will benefit ISIS. And the Taliban will lose or risk losing a lot of their people to ISIS and other groups. Because the more the Taliban become pragmatic, the more disillusioned their own ranks will be, because they've been brought on a very heavy dose of ideology. And as I said earlier, they're not prepared for governance. And therefore, if they see the Taliban or perceive the Taliban as compromising on ideals, that will create disillusionment. And ISIS is already hoping that that will happen, because it'll try to exploit that and welcome these people who are disillusioned with the Taliban into their ranks. The Taliban already know this. And therefore, they can't go too far in the direction of pragmatism, because they don't want to empower ISIS in the process and lose people. So they're not going to sever links with al-Qaeda. They're not going to hand over people wanted by several different governments, whether it's China or the Central Asian states or even Pakistan. Pakistan is asking for members of the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is the Pakistani Rebel Alliance that is, you know, an intellectual cousin of the Afghan Taliban. So they're not going to hand over these people. If they do, they risk delegitimizing themselves in the eyes of their own constituency, and will create a lot of room for ISIS to exploit. So this conundrum is why it is unlikely that the Taliban will give up on ideology. They may make certain modifications, but in reality, that's not the case. Moderation isn't something that takes place over the short term. It's a very long-term, multi-generational process, assuming that it's being embraced in earnest in a methodical way. But if it's being forced upon a group, which is the case with the Taliban, then it becomes even more complicated. So I think that it is unlikely that the Taliban will crack down on these various elements. They'll try to keep them under lock and key. Obviously, they don't want to be seen openly by the international community as harboring and allowing all these transnational jihadist groups, whether it's AQ or ISIS or some other group, you know, with foreign fighters inside Afghanistan. They want to be able to demonstrate that their soil is not being used for attacks across the world. But there are limits to what the Taliban can do.
All right. Now I have a question regarding the threat posed by Islamic State Khorasan. Some analysts say it looks like they are likely to bring the Taliban and al-Qaeda even closer together. ISIS-K again attacked Shia Hazari mosques, killing dozens of people in Kunduz and Kandahar. Whoever wants to take this question, how much of a threat do they pose? Talk about their role in Afghanistan under the Taliban and how worried we should be.
I'm Rashan Akidi, and I will take that question on ISIS Khorasan. So ISIS in Khorasan, or the Islamic State in Khorasan, kind of been underlooked for a while. They played a game of going underground, and this is their strategy elsewhere as well. And then they seize the opportunity exactly when it's right for several reasons. The opportunity that gains them the most attention, that puts them in the spotlight. And we saw this first attack and the massive attack that they did surrounding the airport just as the withdrawal was happening, the evacuation was. And Then the threat became ISK or actually a thing. For many people, they seem to have appeared out of nowhere, though they had been established at that time several years before. So in recent days, we heard from Colin Cowell, who's number three at the Pentagon, saying that the threat is quite near, as in within 6 months, ISIS Khorasan might have the ability to actually conduct attacks within the United States, inside America. And that just shows that perhaps the intelligence over the past few years have not been as accurate in assessing their threat. Now, why have they decided to re-energize? The Taliban victory is what caused that. It's what re-energized them. There's obviously, as it's well known, a rivalry between the Taliban and ISK. They are not allies. They have been fighting each other for a long time, since pretty much the establishment of the concept of the Islamic State. The Taliban rejects the concept of caliphate. They have a completely different ideology and understanding of state and state building and rule and how they want to carry out their rule, despite both of them being more on the radical and extreme side. Neither of them can allow the other to have a victory. But the Taliban were seen by the larger extremists and radicals, whether armed or unarmed, as victorious, as the group that brought America down to its knees, as the group that was successful in defeating the United States and the international coalition that forced them to leave Afghanistan. And we saw celebrations of different groups, armed groups, including the HTS in Syria and other factions celebrating the Taliban. We also saw online forums of radical people also celebrating the Taliban's victory. That put ISIS and other groups into a re-energizing mode. Even in other places outside of Afghanistan, even in Iraq, even in Syria, they decided to make themselves more visible. And in Afghanistan right now, there's so many security vacuums and there's space for ISK to have leeway to operate, because the Taliban, as my colleague Nick will also talk about soon, they do not know at this moment how to operate a state. They do not control the security forces properly as a state should. So there's a lot of vacuum and spaces for ISK, who know how to navigate these areas very well, who know how to exploit the opportunity when it's present to conduct attacks and achieve the highest amount of harm possible. Also, their targets are more vast. This is not to say that the Taliban are moderate in any way, but since they have taken over Kabul, they have made statements that appear less extreme towards the Hazaras, for example. They've expressed their will to protect them if needed, whereas ISIS will attack any minority and will attack women, will attack children. They have no red lines. And they also attack Afghans in massive numbers, whether it be the translators, be them the people who work with the United States, the armed forces. They have those targets perhaps in common with the Taliban, but to a much larger extreme. As to how serious this threat is and what the United States can do, we might see once again drone attacks or directed airstrikes, which, as we have seen in the last few months, have caused massive humanitarian tragedies and are often inaccurate, that could lead to more civilian casualties. But given that the United States and the coalition are not going to re-enter Afghanistan for the purpose of fighting ISK, we might see an escalation of this. As for the Taliban, how they are going to act, bringing them closer to Al-Qaeda is definitely an option for them, perhaps one of the few that they might have. And we will see this play out in different attacks. So far, the Taliban do not seem to have a plan, from what I've just been observing, on how they aim to at least tackle the ISK threat. And they seem to be just, if an attack happens, there's no response, there's just statements. So it's definitely a phenomenon to observe. As to how realistic it is, if the intelligence is saying that there could be a possible threat, that definitely means that they are operating and that they are plotting, and that ISK do not intend to keep their attacks on a local scale within Afghanistan alone.
Well, thanks, Rasha. Let me turn now to Caroline Rose with respect to security vacuums, to which Rasha alluded, and also the series of geopolitical challenges that lie ahead. Your paper indicates that South and Central Asia could face violent spillovers to neighboring states, you know, like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, and that China and Russia may exploit that. But the United States could perhaps use its influence with these countries as leverage. How do you see that scenario?
Well, thanks so much, Carol. Certainly, this is now the withdrawal in Afghanistan has introduced a very interesting predicament for both Central and South Asia, one that is prompted a lot of Central Asian republics to really change their tune in how they approach counterterrorism issues, how they court and interact with great powers in the region, and how to achieve really a balancing act between China, Russia, Iran, and even to a certain extent, the United States, especially as the U.S. is trying to identify over the horizon capabilities in the region with Pakistan and with other partners in the region. And so this has really thrust a lot of neighboring and bordering states, for example, Tajikistan, into a conundrum where they're trying to prevent this violent overspill of potential terrorist organizations. They're also trying to curb a lot of domestic terrorist organizational activity and at the same time retain and sustain a level of interest that they've had on both economic and security terms with great powers, for example, China through the Belt and Road Initiative, and then Russia through their kind of security guarantor position and role in Central Asia. Regarding how the United States approaches this, this is even more so of a very interesting question, because now the United States does not have any sort of permanent basing system in the region. As we've seen, they have now started to interact with Pakistan, with Tajikistan and other Central Asian states, even to some extent Russia, in trying to jointly use Russian bases and Russian facilities to conduct reconnaissance and intelligence collection operations. And the United States has not yet been successful. And so now the United States, it's boxed out of this region and it is on the outside looking in. It has certainly bases in the Persian Gulf that can conduct over the horizon operations, but it's still a bit far, you know, to conduct these sort of aerial operations from this region. And it's really looking for a position somewhere in Afghanistan's immediate periphery. So that way you can both keep an eye on some of this terrorist activity, and then of course, try and help and support essentially staving instability and the overspill of insecurity in the region. So it's a very interesting dynamic. I think the United States is certainly trying to identify new partners and new alliance systems that it can forge in the region, especially as it not only seeks to prevent violent overspill from Afghanistan, but also, of course, monitor Russian and Chinese and even Iranian activity. So this is a very interesting dynamic that we're seeing playing out, this kind of new geopolitical landscape in the region because of the withdrawal in Afghanistan.
I'd like now to turn to Nicholas Haras. I would like you, if you can, to talk about one of the last sentences in your article, which said that while the U.S. failed in its 20-year effort to establish a viable Afghan state, it did succeed in engendering a vibrant civil society, and that it would behoove the Biden administration to do all it could, both diplomatically and through financial leverage, to secure the societal gains. And I'm sure that chief among them would be preserving the rights that women and girls achieved. I mean, we're seeing now the Taliban reneging on their pledges. Girls are still banned from secondary school. How would you recommend that the Biden administration engage both financially and diplomatically to secure these societal gains since the withdrawal?
Well, thank you, Carol. You know, there's an interesting dynamic right now because the Taliban is still in what we would call the consolidation stage of trying to build the state. It had operated what was, for all intents and purposes, a shadow state, especially in some of the Pashtun majority areas of southern Afghanistan. And it had quietly spread out a network of influence into other communities, into other areas of Afghanistan, playing on popular discontent with the Ghani government and with an order that had been established that was in many ways trying to consolidate power in the position of the presidency under Ashraf Ghani. And so there are tremendous challenges that the Taliban faces moving forward. One, which you mentioned already, is that you have a looming disaster when it comes to famine in Afghanistan. Millions of Afghans right now will be facing a winter where they don't have enough to eat. There are at least 3.5 million Afghan people who are still internally displaced within the country. You're starting to see a level of hunger and food insecurity in major urban areas that will metastasize. And even in the Taliban's own heartland in southern Afghanistan, in places like Kandahar and Helmand, people do not have enough food. That in and of itself is a challenge. Another challenge that the Taliban has, both Kamran and Rasha have mentioned this, is that when the Taliban cannot even pay its own foot soldiers, it can't even maintain a basic level of enforcement of its order. And that's when you begin to see what many Afghans have called, you know, a certain semblance of security that's been instituted since the events in August begin to break down. And so there's a challenge here that's linked to the U.S. and international role. For all intents and purposes, Afghanistan was a rentier state. And while it wasn't a rentier state with oil or other energy resources, it was a rentier state where the state essentially distributed, like a river, humanitarian and international assistance down into the provinces for the broader society. With U.S. and Western hesitance to recognize the Taliban and to turn that spigot of support back on, that rentier state that the Taliban was hoping to tap into isn't present. And so then you see these problems begin to magnify. This ties into civil society in the sense that over the last two decades, you went from a harsh, austere Islamic emirate that was imposed by the Taliban, which in many ways was instituted as a form of Pashtun majoritarianism upon the rest of a diverse country, into a civil society that, although it still faced many challenges, was more diverse, included more minority voices, included more women, and more important than anything else, tried through the support of international organizations and non-governmental organizations to create a sense of local ownership over local problems. And this fits Afghanistan as fundamentally due to Afghanistan's geography and the history of its various component peoples. It is a nation that's made up of its regions. In many ways, it's regions that have a nation stamped onto them with a government in Kabul. And so there has to be metrics that are imposed by the United States and its European allies that basically say to the Taliban, you want to run a government, you have to run a government that's inclusive. You have to run a government that's not going to allow terrorist havens to form in the country. You also have to run a government that demonstrates to us that you can secure these gains that have been made and empower in women and allow in divergent voices, because that is what you said and you claimed you would do when we engaged in a peace process with you. Now, there is a devil's dilemma, of course, Carol, and that devil's dilemma is you have tens of millions of Afghans right now who could suffer severely without having international assistance provided to them. And so there is this delicate dance of how do you impose metrics on governance inclusivity upon the Taliban to give them greater recognition and potentially technical support to help out the regions of Afghanistan, while at the same time providing for the people of Afghanistan who will suffer greatly. And there is no clear road ahead, but there does need to be a metric calibrated for that.
Well, thank you so much. And as we close, I'm going to throw out one question is the last sentence of your paper. It says Afghanistan's civil society has the potential to challenge the Taliban in ways that an armed resistance could not. What do you mean by that? Who would like to take on that question?
I can take that.
Cameron Bulkadi, go right ahead.
Thank you, Carol. So in terms of armed resistance, the Taliban were undoubtedly the single most powerful group that could overwhelm every other group. And in fact, the state that Washington and its allies spent 20 years building. That is the tradecraft that the Taliban know best. What they don't know is how to deal with people. And a people who have seen and tasted freedom, empowerment across society, particularly empowerment of women, not just through educational opportunities, but in the workforce and at the highest levels of the state, with a large number of parliamentarians, governors, women in the police force. And so that is a society that the Taliban do not know how to deal with. That is something that they cannot just completely suppress or fight their way through. And I think that that is going to be a resistance to the Taliban, because these people, while they may not be able to put together an armed resistance and challenge the Taliban in an effective way anytime soon, this is a gathering storm as far as the Taliban are concerned, because they are going to be unable to deliver on the basic needs of governance And these people not just require the basic necessities of life, food, shelter, and clothing, but they're also very much in tune with the higher human potential of what can be realized, because they enjoyed that in the 20 years that the United States was present in the country. You can't expect these people to just cow down under the Taliban. They may not be able to come out in large numbers and protest, because there's a wait and see, and there's a certain level of demoralization across the society. And of course, there's widespread sentiment that they have been abandoned by the international community. But these people are not just going to go away. There are only so many people who can become refugees and leave the country. So that's what we mean by people as being the true resistance, because they will challenge the Taliban in ways in which the Taliban do not know how to be able to respond.
Nicholas Heras, Caroline Rose, Rasha Al-Kidi, and Cameron Bohari are all analysts at the New Lines Institute here in Washington. Thanks to all of you for sharing your wisdom and insights about the state of play in Afghanistan. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.